years now. Ideally, he wants to get to a point where he doesn't need to write them out every day, where they have become automatic axioms that flash in his mind in certain stressful situations. The list changes as the norms become incorporated into his behavior. An old one is dropped, a new one is added. This is true of many learning experiences. When you're first learning something new, it's very uncomfortable. Only when you do it for a while does it become more comfortable, to the point where you can do it without even thinking about it. The more and more you do something, soon it becomes a habit and a skill, and then it sinks out of your conscious mind and you do it naturally. Driving is a perfect example. At one point in our lives, for those of us who drive, we had to pay attention to everything. Now we drive and our minds are not even on what we are doing. We just drive automatically, on autopilot. For Ron, putting an item on his list of intentions bridges the gap, bringing the need into his awareness so he can start to work on it. Writing affirmations versus speaking them. Ron writes the same things every day, partly as affirmation, but also, he says, as a focusing thing and a memory thing. The list of intentions helps him remember the kind of person he is striving to be. It is an umbrella, cumulatively creating an attitude, a foundation. These reminders set a pattern for me for when I go out into the world. Then I go out with a focus. I intend to do these things. I intend to monitor my thoughts, to be here and now, and to minimize the size of the food portions I eat, to talk less and listen more, and all the other things. And having the intention makes them more likely to happen. To write it out means I will live this way. This will be my focus. My pen could not copy anything I did not believe in. As I write each principle, I think about it and test my commitment to it. Ron knows that many people might prefer to write up such a list as his once or type it out and then simply reread it every day to reference the concepts by hearing themselves say them out loud. That technique would not be as effective for him. The reason that I write it out every day is to find out how connected I am. The very act of writing it out makes him ask himself, "Am I here and now?" When I wake up, I'm in a different state. I've come out of a dream state, and sometimes I'm scattered. Sometimes it takes me a little while to write that list because I can't think of them, even though I write them every day. It is a measure for me of how alert my mind is and how connected I am, how grounded on a particular day. If I am spacey or can't remember something and need to look at the previous day's intention sheet, then I know to take that lack of sharpness, edge, or presence into account during the day, making adjustments when necessary. Feeding the inner mind. Ron believes that writing it down feeds the inner mind, the other-than-conscious mind. A vividly imagined image with emotional content is as strong as an actual experience as far as the brain and the other-than-conscious mind is concerned. By constantly feeding things to my other-than-conscious mind, I provide the universe with descriptions of the things that I am requesting of the world. That's another reason I write these items down every day. The list of intentions has become for Ron a way to organize and arrange processes of accelerated learning and apply them to his daily behavior. The benefits for me come in the depth and the richness of my life. Now you. For Ron, writing his goals and principles down every day is a way of imprinting them on his behavior. It influences his life. For him, it is like brushing his teeth and washing his face every morning. He just does it, and it wakes him up for the day ahead. His list is personal and has meaning and application for him. Create your own list of what is meaningful to you. We often come across pithy aphorisms and striking concepts in our reading or conversation or in taking a course. We see the wisdom of the notion and nobly pledge to incorporate its insight into our daily living. All too soon it is forgotten before we have practiced it enough to make it a habit. Make your own list of intentions and begin your day by writing them out. It need not be from memory. As you move into competence in one area, drop this saying you don't even have to think about anymore and add another maxim. The benefit when you do this will come in the depth and richness of your life. 11. Becoming committed. In an oft-quoted passage from the Scottish Himalayan Expedition, W. H. Murray speaks to the significance of commitment. Once you walk forward in faith with a conscious effort, all manner of support and tangible backing will be available to you. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events raising in one's favor. Unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. It is up to you to trust the possibility enough to be willing to put your dream in writing and to take the first step, even with no evidence that it will actually happen. Bill's story. My good friend Bill was having recurring dreams, not really nightmares, but sometimes they woke him up in the middle of sleep or left him feeling uneasy when he woke up in the morning. His 30th college reunion from Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Troy, New York, was coming up, and the dreams were about school. A lot of people have dreams like this occasionally, dreams when you can't find the class, you can't find your locker, you don't remember if you did the homework. The difference was I started having them all the time. Bill is an easygoing kind of fellow, with an incisive mind and dry wit. The milieu at Rensselaer Polytech, considered one of the finest engineering science schools in the country, suited him just fine. Bill remembers his college years fondly, the fraternity parties, the camaraderie, the school spirit. He laughs at the memory of the time the whole town converged and tore the goalpost down for a tie game. It was the football team's first non-loss in 4 years. He wanted to go back. It was important to him. But at the same time, he did not think it was possible. Since he lives on the West Coast, plane fare would be expensive, and then he'd have to rent a car and get a hotel. His wife Dorothy's business was expanding, and they were sinking a lot of their finances into it. Money was tight. A trip back east seemed out of the question. Bill decided building up Dorothy's business was more consequential than his desire to attend his reunion. And then the dream started. Even though I had a very positive experience in school, the dreams were scary. Like, we're getting ready for the final exam, and I don't know where the classroom is. And I didn't remember studying, even taking any classes. Then there was the locker dream, which went like this. I had a locker where I had my books. There were walls and walls of lockers, and I couldn't remember which one was mine. But I need to find the locker, because all the information is in there, including the book that tells me where the class is, which I don't remember. Bill also had dreams where he was walking through neighborhoods, trying to find the school, and the fraternity was on the top of an elevated highway. The funny part was the dream landscape had nothing to do with the way things were. In real life, the fraternity is located on a plateau part of the campus. But the sense in the dream was that it was inaccessible or scary, or that I was trying to reach something and couldn't get it. Then he had dreams where there were parties going on upstairs in the fraternity house. He could hear them, but not find them. He had trouble finding his way around. All of the dreams had in common dark locked rooms, a mysterious unused stairwell, and a big heavy door. I felt something cryptic about that door, like it was an arcane, closed-off place. The dreams were all about secret passages, or finding places, even the locker dream. But Bill is not sure what the metaphor was for any of the dreams. If I had to guess, I would guess searching for the locker, not being able to find the class, the locked door, and closed stairwell, all had to do with finding my way in life. Bill went through the letters that the reunion committee sent to him about the big event and put the red and white Save This Date magnet on his refrigerator. Then he got a call from his friend Jeff, his classmate and fraternity brother. Jeff was part of the group putting together the reunion for the class. Bill told Jeff he wanted to go, but he didn't think he could manage it financially. Jeff said, "Well, think about it. I'll put you down as maybe." The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to be there, and the more impossible it seemed. I kept telling myself that I had to do this. Write it down. It was Dorothy who suggested to Bill that he write down his intention. So he did. A single sentence in an old journal. "This is what I want to accomplish. I want to return to Rensselaer for my 30th reunion." I wrote it in my journal. Yeah, I have a journal, which I write in every 6 or 7 years. He laughs. I'm big on journalizing. The time approached when Bill had to make a final decision. Even though they still didn't have the money, the deadline came, and Bill told Jeff, "Yes, I'll be there. I'm coming. I'm going to do it. Put me down as a definite." And he sent the deposit for the dinner. "So I committed to be there." He sniffs and shakes his head, still somewhat incredulous about how he took a decisive step of ascent without a clue as to how he would pull it off. What opened up? It was getting closer and closer to the date. It got to the point where he had to purchase plane tickets. The reunion was in a few weeks. He was still trying to figure out how he was going to pay for the airfare, hotel, and car rental. Meantime, Dorothy was juggling the books for the business. One day, she was bemoaning the huge phone bill when her eye caught a notice at the bottom of the bill about the long-distance charges being linked to frequent flyer miles. She called the airlines and found a way to combine the phone points with what she had already earned in Sky Miles. Between the two systems, they had enough miles to arrange for the ticket. After that, things started happening fast. When his brother, John, who lives on New York's Long Island, heard that Bill wanted to go back for his reunion, he said he had an extra car. By coincidence, John had just bought a truck. Otherwise, he would have needed his car to get to work. "Now I could fly into New York City and drive upstate, which is a heck of a lot easier than trying to fly into a little place like Troy." There were more surprises in store. Bill's parents, who live in North Carolina, heard he was going back. They sent him a letter with a large check saying, "Have a good time. Here's some money." I wasn't expecting that at all. It was generous of them, and it was out of the blue. And then his college chum, Jeff, said, "Don't bother about a hotel. You can stay with me." Now he had everything he needed. The reunion. Bill was met at the airport by his brother John, and he visited with family before heading north to the reunion. He linked up with his pal Jeff, and together they went to the fraternity house. When he got there, he knew his way around instantly. And he knew the people, even the ones who at first looked quite different. No matter what the exterior, people didn't change that much inside. I know people grow. Dorothy and I have been married for 27 years. Our relationship has grown, and we've changed a lot. Yet what I learned, going back to seeing my old classmates, was yes, you probably do grow and change, but there is something in your personality that doesn't change. Your sense of humor, or nonsense of humor, the way you look at life in general, and the way you interact with other people. There are certain basic things about you that just don't change. Of the people that were at the reunion, all of them were pretty much the same in some fundamental way. Their personalities were the way they were 30 years ago. There is security in that, because you can look at yourself and say, "I am the same person. I haven't become a different person." I can look at these people and say, "Yes, Jeff is still Jeff. Dave is still Dave. Good for them." And I can look at myself and say, "I'm still me." It is a reassurance to know that people don't change. That tells you that there is something in each of us, as an individual, that is all our own. Why write? Bill likens writing down his goal to an article he read recently about engineers building bridges. The author of the piece poses the question, what makes the difference between somebody who fantasizes something and somebody who uses their imagination? The answer is commitment. An engineer uses his imagination to design something with the idea of bringing it to reality. When you fantasize, there is no commitment to creating it. whereas when you imagine something with a personal commitment, it gets built. The distinction is commitment. What writing it down did was it got me out of fantasy to the level of commitment. There is a solidity in actually committing it to paper. It is a physical thing to put it on paper. Not a lot of people write. For me, to write it down is an unusual event. Writing something down is a commitment. A completion. After he came back from the reunion, Bill felt like he had fulfilled some kind of obligation. I had gone back and checked the reality against the dream. I'm glad I went. There were not any secrets that I found out about myself or anyone else. It was more of a completion, like I was supposed to go. And after he went, the dream stopped. Now you. The first step of commitment is to be willing to write down what you want. Then take some small action toward the realization of that dream, even in the face of evidence to the contrary. And then don't be surprised when support comes from unlikely places. As Julia Cameron puts it, leap and the net will appear. 12. Stacking goals. Raising the bar. You can have more than one goal at a time, and let the success of one be the foundation for another. A bonus awaits you when you conquer a fear or master a skill. Often you get two for the price of one, as a growth you make in one area of your life shows up as a strength in another. Mark's batting cage story. Because he started late in singing, my friend Mark, whom I write about in Chapter 2, felt he had a lot to catch up on. I was afraid all the time of what was going to happen. Painstakingly, I stopped doing other things I enjoyed, put my nose to the grindstone, and worked at learning how to sing. I went about it very badly, from a logical, left-brained, first-things-first kind of approach. Eventually it started to pay off, but it can take you just so far when you do things that way. When he was offered a major part at a major house, he was both thrilled and frightened. I had a crisis before I went to do that gig. Essentially, I was on the verge of having a career. Going there could move me forward in terms of me letting go, and it scared me. I was scared, scared, scared. Mark decided to confront his performance anxiety by encountering head-on his fear of sports. To understand the background of how he solved the problem and broke through the crisis, you need to know that when Mark was a kid growing up, he was never good at baseball and was often the last one chosen for teams at school. I was a horrible athlete, very self-conscious. When they were drawing up sides, I was always picked last. One year, a kid in a body cast was chosen to play ahead of me. Mark decided to combat this old ghost with a decisive present-day action. He went with some friends to a batting cage to hit baseballs. By the end of the day, Mark felt his confidence and competence growing. And his hunch was right. The experience in the batting cage spilled over to his singing. The first time into the cage, he actually hit the ball a couple of times, which was a huge surprise to him. The third time into the cage, he hit the ball 12 out of 16 times. It was the third time into the cage that I knew I could sing better. Mark now looks for ways to stretch all the time. If he goes into a restaurant and the waitress suggests trying squid as a sushi appetizer, he is willing to order it, even if it is new to him and he might be afraid he won't like it. I do that more and more, challenge myself to do things I've never done before, constantly try to move out of my comfort zone, try the thing on the menu I have not tried before just to try it. Because I know that every time I do that, I get a little better as a singer because I get a little braver. Expanding childhood limitations. Doing something that seems insurmountable often has to do with defying childhood injunctions. We get to go back and contradict those childhood limits and rewrite the rules. There has to be a willingness to do it poorly at first and give yourself a pat on the back for doing it at all. Anything worth doing is worth doing, period. As my friend Carol Keefe likes to say. Janine once used an expression of how something was stuck in my head even though I did not know it was in my head. She was referring to that magical, subliminal way that things happen when we write them down and forget about them. There is a flip side to the phenomenon. Negative phrases like, I can't do this, they'll laugh, let me help. Even under the guise of kindness, it only implies that you are doing it all wrong, and you'll fail, get ingrained deep in our psyches, messages that get stuck in your head even though you don't know they are in your head. Now that you are grown up, you can set the record straight. We each have our own stumbling blocks. What is easy for one person might be a formidable task for another. Last Halloween, I carved a pumpkin for the first time in my life. In the past, I always thought everyone could carve better than I, so I let them do it. Or if I tried and messed it up, or even hesitated, it was, here, let me do that, taking the knife out of my hand. On Halloween, my sons James and Peter invited me over. They had purchased pumpkins, spread out the newspaper, and they insisted, here's the knife, you're doing your own. At first I was intimidated. I knew it would not be as inventive as theirs, because they are marvelously clever. I did it anyway. I made a Chinese one in honor of Puccini's Turandot. It wasn't very good, but it was mine. It felt freeing and fun. The happiness I felt, the sense of accomplishment, spilled over into my next workday. I smiled broadly every time I thought of it. Now I use that accomplishment as a metaphor for other things in my life. When I felt overwhelmed by a recent major move, Janine gave me a picture of a little girl carving a huge pumpkin, with a big grin on her and the pumpkin's face. I slapped it up on my refrigerator with a magnet and looked at it every day before tackling the moving boxes, the closets of stuff to discard, the attic of accumulated paperwork, the garage full of car and garden tools. The picture said, "You can do this, and it's fun." Transferring success. My friend Bob McChesney calls it stacking. One success becomes leverage for the next. Learning to use a computer back when that was a new concept helped me in my writing. There were those who said, "You'll never be able to figure it out. You are too right-brained." Looking back now, I remember appreciatively how helpful my friend Bill Harrison was. When I couldn't get the computer to do what I wanted, Bill used to say, "What does the computer think you asked it to do?" Bill explained that whenever something went wrong, it was right for the computer. I later heard this approach described with a fancy name, emphatic identification, which means becoming one with the machine you are trying to master, getting inside its head. It is a secret tool many mechanically inclined people use when troubleshooting. The point is, I did learn to use a computer, and doing that made me a sharper writer. Not because I could now drag down a thesaurus, or because word processing made deletions easy and moving blocks around smooth, but because the confidence I gained in my own ability to think had a lateral transfer to my creative work. I became more logical and organized my ideas better. Coining a metaphor. Here is a stacking story that continues to color a whole life. An accomplished friend of mine takes on new challenges so confidently, I once asked her where she got her fearlessness from. Edna told me it had to do with something that happened when she was a young girl. She had seen a performer on TV riding a unicycle, and she got it into her head that that was a splendid, magnificent kind of thing to be able to do. Such balance, such grace, such freedom and insouciance. No bars for hands to steer, unrestricted and free. The person on the unicycle looked so happy, even smug and natural. It looked easy. Edna rented a unicycle from a shop near Alki Point. That's when she found out it was not as easy as it looked. She kept falling off. She kept at it and got better and better, although still a little wobbly. She got good enough to convince her parents to buy her her very own unicycle for a birthday present. Now she could practice to her heart's content. Soon Edna was as casual as the man on TV appeared, riding down to the library, to the store for her mom, with a satchel over one shoulder to carry back books or groceries, to a friend's house after school. It was as natural as walking, only speedier and more fun. She liked the way the wind ran through her hair as she pedaled along. She liked the smiles of passers-by and the animated pointing of young children as she rode past. She liked the maneuverability and the way she could hop on and go. Mostly, she was proud of herself for doing something she did not know she could do. It became emblematic of her drive and ability. When Edna was studying French years later and having a tough time of it, her mother said, "A girl who could ride a unicycle could learn French." So she persevered, and soon was doing so well in her French class, the teacher asked her to tutor others. She wanted a job after school, a part in the spring play. It became a familiar refrain, a cheer. A girl who could ride a unicycle could get a job like that, could audition and get picked, could act, could, whatever. Edna laughs now to remember it. After a while, the significant triumphs that built on that one girlhood feat could have replaced it many times over as a milestone to measure other challenges by. But she always kept that one as her mantra. And, of course, there were things she tried that did not work out, but she never paid much mind to those. A girl who can ride a unicycle knows she has options. Putting a man on the moon. What does putting a man on the moon have to do with fighting global hunger? Rhetoricians would say, correctly, it is a false analogy. That is, comparing two activities that are alike in trivial ways, but dissimilar in significant ways. Oh well. The fact is that as a country, we have been motivated time and time again to do other great things because of that one small step for a man, one giant step for mankind. A country that could put a man on the moon could... And then we collectively figure out a way to do it. It doesn't matter how tenuous the connection seems. What does riding a unicycle have to do with speaking French fluently? What does being in the batting cage have to do with singing well? Nothing. And everything. This same mysterious connection happens when you begin writing things down and watch them happen. Synchronicity starts to inform all areas of your life. Soon the miracles are happening so fast, you can hardly keep track of them. Now you. Write a list of the accomplishments in your life of which you feel especially proud. It could be something you did last week, or something you did as a kid. Won a coloring contest. Swam the length of the pool. Got the promotion. Use that list to choose your own private batting cage benchmark. Select one that resonates for you. Or set out today to conquer a childhood block. Carve a pumpkin. Learn to bat. Take roller skating lessons. Make it your mantra, a girl or boy or man or woman who could do that could do anything. If you have written a goal and made it happen, do another harder one, maybe in another part of your life. Or if you are stuck in a goal achievement, as Mark was, try for another accomplishment in a totally different arena that will boost your confidence. You just might get two or more for the price of one. 13. Starting a group. What by when? If you are serious about having what you want in life, determine to meet systematically with like-minded people as a way to spur you on and assess your advancement. The deadline energy of having an appointment, with assignments due, can motivate completion. And, by pointing out the progress you might have missed, give you an incentive to do even more. At its best, such a group calls you to your highest ability and holds your vision even when your own sight dims. The Seymour Group. For several years now, I have profited immensely by being part of the Seymour Group. The Seymour Group meets every week, once a week on Friday mornings at Vivace's. Or not. We meet at precisely 8 a.m. The members are always punctual. They arrive exactly on time, ready to report on their week's assignments, or not. The members are scrupulous about keeping strictly to business, honoring each other's time, and rarely, if ever, bring up topics of a personal nature. Oh, well, we try. And the point is that a group can be whatever you want it to be, whatever brings out the best in you. If you form a group like ours, you might want to meet at exactly the same time each week and allow each person 15 minutes of reporting on his or her goals, during which time no one else interrupts. You might want to use a timer for this to make sure no one person holds the floor longer than another. After each member has his or her allotted 15 minutes, you might consider a summary and projection of the week ahead, totaling 10 minutes apiece, and again, use a timer to keep everyone on track. Then again, you might not. Either way, whether you play by set rules or make up new ones as you go along, a regular goal gathering can be a dramatic guide through the nitty-gritty, step-by-step task of making wishes come true. The secret. The Seymour Group is the kind of loose-fitting team that works best for me. But I admit we are a bit unconventional. The first convention we violate is that groups of this type ordinarily have 4 to 8 members. The secret is, please don't tell anybody, there are just 2 of us, my friend Janine and me, and we like it that way. That way, if one or the other of us is late, or does not show up at all, which has happened on occasion, only one other person is inconvenienced, and that other person is understanding and forgiving, because she was probably late or forgot to show up herself not so long ago. We have enormous patience with each other and allow all kinds of topics to crop up that are not on the agenda. It works for us. We have figured out how to combine fun with hard work. Janine and I named our get-togethers Group, so you wouldn't know our club only has 2 members, and called it the Seymour Group, so it sounded as important as an investment meeting. Of course, it is an investment meeting, but the stock is in ourselves, and the dividends pay a higher yield than most mutual funds. Wishcraft. I sincerely believe that Barbara Scher herself would be delighted with our Maverick Club, even though she is the one who made up most of the standards we break every week, or every other week, depending on when we get together. Barbara Scher wrote the wonderful book Wishcraft, and I took a high-energy course from her years ago. Scher recommends meeting on a consistent schedule with what she calls success teams to support each other in making dreams reality. In the years since taking Scher's motivating class, I have both formed and joined several different success teams. All of these teams contributed to my life, and I am grateful to them. No matter how the makeup of these groups varied, 2 underlying premises remain the same. 1, if you are headed in the right direction, all you need to do is keep on walking. 2, it's nice to have others who believe in you walking alongside, making suggestions, encouraging you on. The setup is simple. Each week in a little memo book, write down your respective mini goals, the piece of the puzzle that will eventually make the big picture. By next week, I will... And then copy, as well, the other person's promises. This not only makes each of you committed, it also makes you accountable. What? By when? To my mind, the 2 most important questions you can ask a person who is serious about moving forward in a project, any project, are, 1, what will you do next? 2, by when will you do it? And the 3rd key ingredient is the principle of return and report. When I use this formula to challenge someone outside of the Seymour Group as a one-time-only inducement to action, I often add, call me when you have done it. And this one is, as Scher suggests, strictly a business call. Hang up and call back if you want to chat. Recently, I was speaking with a young woman who was ready to claim her goal. She was clear what the next step would be, yet I startled her by asking, point blank, okay, by when will you do that? With great enthusiasm, she answered confidently, soon. She felt proud of herself, so imagine her surprise at my rejoinder. Soon is not an answer. By when will you do it? Now she was more tentative. Sunday? I guess I could do that by Sunday. Okay. Will you call me on Sunday and leave a message on my machine telling me that you did that? She did, and she did. When return and report is, by agreement, an ongoing arrangement, like the regular meetings of the Seymour Group, then the next step, after the report, is to throw the marker out a little farther and challenge each member to swim toward a new micro-goal. Okay, you sent for the catalog. By next week, will you call the Dean of Admissions and get a registration form? Congratulations, you got the classical guitar you have been coveting. How many hours will you put in next week for lessons and practice? Keeping your eye upon the donut. I know a new dad who wrote a letter to his just-born son. Let the rest of the world be the heavy. I want to be your champion. Your goal group needs to offer that kind of unconditional bias. A goal group is no place for tough love or ultimatums. It is a fan-to-fan forum where the key is positive reinforcement. Janine is a good example of this for me. She is natural and easygoing, and maternal. I like that. She claps at even my baby steps. When it seems as though I am going nowhere, Janine is quick to say, "Look what you did." Okay, so you didn't accomplish A, B, and C. We'll put those on the list for next week. But give yourself some credit. You did do D, E, and F. Nice work. My dear dad taught me a lesson I sometimes forget. A jingle he was fond of spouting epitomizes his philosophy on life. As you amble on through life, friend, whatever be your goal, keep your eye upon the donut, and not upon the hole. A good goal group will acknowledge what is, rather than dwell on what isn't. You begin to see how it all fits together. One foot after the other. The stumbling baby steps become a steady walk. Chip, chip, chip. The resumes are done and in the mail. The attic cleaned. The house is ready to go on the market. The sorting boxes properly filled. The dreaded phone call placed and successful. By next week, I will, week after week, step by step. The new small business is successfully launched. The trip taken. The foreign language facilitated. The walk turns to a run as you triumphantly cross the finish line. And, hardly hesitating, look around for the next challenge. Rising to the challenge. When I say that Janine is easygoing, I don't mean easy. Janine demands a lot of me, and I, in turn, help raise her bar. You can do the same with your group. The Seymour group often challenges each other to stretch, to reach higher than what we think we can do. I constantly come up with plans for Janine that seem impossible in the allotted time frame. And she, in turn, spurs me on to do the undoable with her pet phrase, said with a sweet smile that disarms the stern schoolmarm tone. Quite matter-of-factly, with raised eyebrows and a motherly up-and-down nod of the head, she says, "You can do this." The impression I am left with is strong. Someone else has confidence in me. Why shouldn't I? We go way back. The longer your group continues to meet, the more bolstering you can be. You can remind each other of past conquests as batting cage benchmarks for future triumphs. 2 years ago, Janine and I together did the 3-day novel writing contest that I mentioned previously in Ron's story and talk about in Put Your Heart on Paper. We often reference that to reinforce our respective resolve. A girl who could write a novel in 3 days could. The next trick is to break down big chunks of challenge into controllable segments. Janine wanted to enter the annual 200-mile STP, Seattle to Portland, bike ride. A girl who could write a novel in 3 days could do that. All she has to do is break the training down into manageable parts and write down one piece at a time. Janine knew she could go 10 miles at a stretch, and there was a loop right near her home to Seward Park and back, which was 10 miles. I challenged her to pedal that path 7 times between our present meeting and the next one. 5 times is reasonable. Anything more would be a bonus. Okay, 50 miles biking by next week, for sure. Aim for 70. She wrote down, 50 miles biking, 10 miles at a time, by next week. This is good. This makes it possible, in small bites. TTTT. Janine and I have been meeting regularly for almost 3 years. I have filled 4 or 5 memo books, including a small gilded one from Florence. Meet Emily in Italy was one of my goals, broken down into manageable parts. When I read over the weekly bullets in those books, I see how commitment plus accountability helped Janine to first finish and then submit her historic novel for publication, bike that 200-mile STP, plan a romantic weekend getaway with her husband, propose and receive a grant for an in-service curriculum on harassment for the school district, enter her photography in a national contest, and approach a millionaire for a donation to help publish a memoir book for her senior students. For my part, the Seymour Group got me back to Greece, pushed me to proceed in a lawsuit. I won. Guided me in hiring office staff, and got me to propose and write this book, story by story, chapter by chapter. Write 1 chapter, edit 3. Proofread. Draw up table of contents. Edit changes. Enter. Write new, bit by bit. And here it is. This book itself is a tribute to the Seymour Group and Steady On. Those memo books are a treasure to me. They show me the steps that got me where I want to be, over and over and over. They remind me, as my friend John Garner likes to say, TTTT, these things take time. They provide a record of the persistent perspiration that goes along with initial inspiration. Looking back on the weekly challenges checked off shows how we came to this point, the conquests along the way, the building blocks carefully put in place. Because Janine and I have so much darned fun, it doesn't feel like work. But then I look with astonishment at all we accomplish directly because of meeting. Completion creeps up on you. The important thing is to do something. Anything that propels you forward, keeps the dream fresh in your reticular activating system, so you will be attuned to signs, start collecting evidence. You can do this. Before you know it, you are sipping wine on a sidewalk cafe in Paris, or taking orders, fast and furious, for your new business. You are so busy enjoying yourself, you might forget there was ever a time when you thought it was not possible. Now you. Read Barbara Sher's Wishcraft. Form a goal group that reflects your own best style. There is no right or wrong way to do it. Cheer each other on as you take the steps that will eventually lead to completion of your dreams. Each week, ask each other, what will you do by next week to further your goal? Write it down, then return and report the following week. Before you know it, your old goals will be history, and you will be setting new ones. You will have climbed every mountain you dreamed of and be scaling heights you never thought possible. Trust me, you can do this. 14. Taking the Initiative. My children always love the story of Dumbo the Flying Elephant. They begged me to read it to them over and over. You remember the plot. Everyone made fun of the elephant with the big ears until he was befriended by a mouse who gave him a magic feather. With this feather, Dumbo could fly. Now he was soaring and wowing the crowds. Those who derided him were applauding wildly. He was confident and free until he dropped the feather. Immediately, Dumbo plummeted toward the ground and was heading for a crash when the mouse, who was along for the ride, shouted in his ear, "Dumbo, it's not the feather, it's you. You know how to fly." Hearing that, Dumbo righted his course and was able to continue soaring on his own powers. When you write down your aspirations, It is true that support often comes from unpredictable outside sources. And yet, especially if you are stuck on a goal, don't lose sight of the implied imperative in the title of this book. You write it down. You make it happen. It's not a magic feather. It's you. Sometimes, in order for your dream to come true, it is you who need to take the initiative. Marion's story. One autumn day, my office phone rang. A woman who lived in Wells, Nevada, population 1,000, was calling. Her name was Marion. Marion had read Put Your Heart on Paper 3 times, she told me, and wanted to know if there was any chance I might come to Wells, America's cowboy poetry outpost, to do a workshop. We got to talking. It felt like we knew each other, like we were old friends. Quite easily, she was soon telling me a remarkable story about an impossible dream come true, one that she wrote down before it happened. Marion and her husband are ranchers. They live in an area so remote that their address has an HC, highway contract number. That means that since neighbors are so far apart, the post office contracts out the mail delivery to a private carrier. There is only one grocery store in Wells. In fact, the only shopping in town is this one store. It is a drugstore and grocery store combined. Any other shopping means a drive to Twin Falls, 2 hours away, or Elko, just over an hour. In a strong yet soft voice that spoke volumes in its tone, Marion filled me in on some background. You have to know our history. My husband and I feel as if we've been with preschool children all of our lives. We had 8 children of our own, and then we adopted 2. We homeschooled our last 3 children. When Marion speaks of preschoolers in the house, she is not referring simply to the children, though. It is her tender way to describe the sense of responsibility she and her husband felt while caring for their aging parents as well. Marion's mother has Alzheimer's, so Marion knows firsthand the deep sadness and helplessness, and even the frustration and resentment, that comes from watching someone you love, someone once sharp and vibrant and self-sufficient, slip into dementia and needing more care than you can provide. So she felt personally the need for families to have help with their elderly. Taking care of aging parents is confining. It's not that people don't want to do it. Others often make that judgment. Those who judge don't understand sometimes how difficult it is to take care of the elderly or even to be close to them. Even a loving and giving daughter or son is frightened to think that they could never be independent again, never go on a trip again without their sick mother or father with them. I know those feelings. I know how difficult it is to have someone with you all the time. But I also know how awful it is to feel that you are not doing your duty, that you are selfish enough to want a life of your own, and want some independence and some freedom. Marion wrote of this dichotomy in her journal. Mom fell this morning. We heard a thud on the monitor we keep beside her bed. I don't know how to make it safer for her. She is so frail and ill-looking. But she can be willful and bossy and demanding, too. Sometimes she is gentle and grateful also. I must learn to ignore the bad times and cherish and remember the good. How do other families cope? For many, it is not possible to give up their work and their personal lives to care for an aged parent. Where can they turn for help? Who will help us? Searching for a place. As she sat in hospital waiting rooms or doctor's offices through a series of major illnesses leading up to the final diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, many times Marion wrote out her dream of a place that could provide for her mother a family away from family. At one point, Marion went with her sisters to Salt Lake City to look at some facilities for seniors that were recommended to her. Jane and Anne think it is time for Mom to move to a rest home. I'm not so sure of that, but I looked anyway. The City Care Center and Upland Cove both are possibilities, but they lack so much. They are both large facilities, looking and smelling like charity hospitals. The personnel were friendly, and on first appearance seemed to care for the elderly. but there are so many old people there, and it is so impersonal. Long, cold halls, so many wheelchairs, such a feeling, was it only me, of waiting for the inevitable, death. Simultaneous entries in her journal show her questioning her own place in the world, asking, now what? What is my purpose? What is it that I am to do at this point in my life? She describes her plight in a picturesque way. I had this strong feeling that I was at the crossroads. I wrote that so many times in my journal. I was stuck, sitting under the sign, with my backpack on my back, waiting for direction. Marion continued to dream on paper of a home where families could get assistance, where they knew that their parents would be well taken care of. Not an institution or a nursing home, not a facility, but a home, a place where there were loving people who could care for them and could socialize with them, talk with them, and hear their stories, and at the same time, provide the physical care that was needed. Marion laughs and says, so out of that was born the idea that someone should do something, but I did not ever think of it as being me. Little did Marion realize that the personal direction she sought would synchronize with her need to ease her mother's plight. Pointing back to her. A chance conversation with a son-in-law was the first inkling that in order to make this particular dream happen, Marion might have to take the initiative herself. Out of the blue, without knowing about her longings or what she had written, her son-in-law said to her one day, "Have you ever thought about building a retirement home?" A friend of his had been in contact with a company called Beehive Development, a new group that built small, family-type homes for seniors around the country. Their idea was born out of the same need as Marion's. The two partners had family members who needed help. Marion made a call, then another, and another. She had to make a dozen calls to track down the two partners. Then things started hopping. Within the week, the CEO of the company had met with me, and we began talking about it. I loved the concept, and I loved the fact that they said that they would never build a bigger home than one which cared for 9 residents. Despite the fact that you can run an 18-bed facility much more inexpensively per person than you can the 8 or 9-bed, they promised they would never enlarge. 9 is still like a family. We began talking about the possibility of building such a place in Nevada. Marion was still reluctant, wishing someone else would build the home. She did not know the first thing about architects and building permits, let alone running such a place. It took great courage for her to start. She had to break new ground every day, dealing with difficult contractors and bureaucratic government officials, called for a toughness that was not her style. She had to work through a maze of rules and regulations that the state required, as well as defend herself against the skeptics and naysayers who said the town did not have enough of a population base to sustain such an undertaking. But there was no getting around it. Everything kept coming back to her being the one to do this. It seemed like something had taken over. We could not get variances anywhere we looked in the larger communities, so finally we decided to come back here. 6 months after the conversation with her son-in-law, they opened the door to the first residence. Marion says proudly, "It is a beautiful building, state-of-the-art for that purpose. My thing is decorating, and it's so lovely, with warm pictures and colors. Every room is embellished a little differently. The nicest thing about it, though, is that the building itself has a welcoming warmth about it." Little miracles seemed to happen at the Beehive home. A man came who had a well-earned reputation for being difficult. He had been an alcoholic and had a foul mouth, returning meanness for kindness at every turn. Yet, poignantly, after 2 weeks, he told Marion, "I recognize you. Don't leave me." One of the women they took in complained about everything. She commandeered the remote and put herself in charge of the TV. She didn't like this, wouldn't do that. But now, Marion says, she has mellowed. Her son told us, "I've never seen this side of her before." I'm not saying she has changed completely. She can still be very rough, but she is more compassionate. Capturing and preserving national treasures. When Marion compared aging parents to preschoolers, she meant it as an attitude to help understand and appreciate seniors' clumsiness and distraction, and to be prepared for their unexpected, sometimes humorous utterances. We don't require preschoolers to do everything right, to even feed themselves correctly. They often do embarrassing things in public, make inappropriate loud noises, or make a big mess, and we don't mind. Marion suggested approaching the way the elderly act, and the curious way they look at the world, with the same sense of patience and enjoyment. By way of example, she tells a story about her own mother, whom she says is both elegant and imperious. My mother is quite tall, beautifully dressed, and absolutely loco right now. Yet she does have these moments when she is right on. There is a day person who prepares the meals, and an evening person who serves the main meal. Mother came and sat down at the dinner table and looked around and said, "Well, they've done their research." Virginia, another resident who is caustic, said, "What do you mean, Lillian?" And Mother said, "Well, they found out everything I hate, and they served it all in one meal." Or the time someone asked Hazel, the oldest resident, if she wanted to go out, and she said, "I'm not sticking my beak out of this building until I've seen the first robin." Marion laughed softly. The staff and I share comments like this with each other, and we are constantly delighted by them. Many of the residents also provide a classic view into life a long time ago. Hazel is 101 years old. She rarely says more than one word at a time. But on February 2nd, she blurted out, "My boy Doug was born on Groundhog Day." Encouraged by the staff, she poured out a marvelous story of Doug's birth, a wonderful tale of good neighbors pulling together, pulling for this little baby to be born. There was a raging blizzard, and Hazel's husband, George, had to travel over 60 miles by horse to Elko, across the Ruby Mountains, through Secret Pass, along steep and winding roads, to get the doctor. All along the way, there were fresh horses waiting for him at the ranches he passed. The return journey was marked by the same neighborliness. In Hazel's words, "He gathered up old Doc Hood. No, not young Tom, but Tom's grandfather, borrowed a buggy, and started back for the ranch. There were teams and wagons stationed all along the way. George and Doc changed outfits and kept on a-comin'. I was mighty glad to see 'em both. It was only a few more hours, and we had us a baby boy. His dad was sure proud of him." When Helen, another resident who has no children, heard Hazel tell this story, she said, "You sure were in labor a long time." Marion smiled as she wrote down Hazel's response. "It was worth it. He's a good boy." Hazel's boy Doug is 82 now, and they typed up this story and gave it to him. "You are never too old to know your dad was proud of you, and your mom thinks you were worth the pain of labor." After giving Hazel's story to Doug, Marion got together with her staff and decided to add something to their mission statement. Marion explained, "We are required by law to keep a daily log, mostly to correspond with each other about what happened that day. I said to my staff, 'Let's make this a real log. Let's write down in dialogue the funny little conversations that take place, or the poignant things we hear.' Now our mission statement says our purpose is threefold: to provide physical care, to provide a loving family atmosphere, and third, to write down the memories of these people who are a national treasure. They need and deserve to have their stories told. The plan is to get them to tell their tales, write them down, and give them in booklets to their relatives." Knowing it was meant to be. One of the best things that has come from this, Marion told me, is the response from the community. So many people said, "Nothing good ever happens in this little town." And now there is this to prove good things do happen here. People have been supportive and thrilled. When they come into the building, they gasp because it is so nice. They didn't expect that we would do it here, and I can't blame them. I never suspected it myself. Marion is well aware what a tremendous gamble this undertaking